Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Reason is our weapon of choice. Skeptics know that you do have a voice. Science, not so we'll be defying it. What we know, so it's best to apply it. Feed you information, deposit the knowledge, so you know ignorance is not an option. Welcome to the RSS feed with your host, Raina Rose. Skeptical superwoman, but in plain clothes. She ain't no Jane Doe, nor is she a day old. So no couple arguments, weakly molded like Plato. Kicking false info like Kato, but it should be a J-O. To expand your mind like a transit line. Nothing is there for you, cause you think so. It's evident that you never win, cause the evidence you present is irrelevant. In the present tense, it's reckless and negligent. Never ask questions or to think ignorance is good and relative. So we cross the debate, cause you know the truth is hard to take. Especially with so many phone calls that we all the days. When we turn reality, we start to face. Shout out to the skeptics, my freak thinking. Deliver cow, missiles, I fire and heat. Seeking an aim that you shoot or win the leg. You weak creatures, Christian science institute, debate, evolution. Elitists of the government that hate the revolution. Armchair, advocate to overstate their contribution to the movement. Cause they say they have solutions. So it's best to listen and understand skepticism is the religion. And so we get a better vision of how the world works in. What we call marvelous to make a better future. You know that it starts with us. Progressive thoughts, progressive talks, the sharing of ideas, the medicine we need. Another dose of the RSSD. Say what? Another dose of the RSSD.
Hey everybody, this is Raina, and I welcome you to my show, the RSS Feed. And today I have a good friend of mine, my guest, Gary C. Booker, who is an educator, a scientist, a tutor, a family man, and everything else. You're multiple categories, aren't you, Gary?
Yes, indeed. I wear a lot of hats.
You wear a lot of hats. And we're going to talk about Gary's various ventures that he's been involved in, as well as his views on space and space science. And, of course, he started an organization called the African Space Science and Policy Institute. So we'll be talking about that, and we'll be getting a little bit into his background. And so it should be a lot of fun. So let's let you tell everyone a little bit about yourself, Gary. Like, where are you from, and where did you grow up? You know, where did you study? You know, how did you get to be who you are?
That is a very, very long story, but to make it short, I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and was a lifelong lover of science and space. I had felt the love affair with the sky since I was, since as far back as I can remember.
And, I think I read in your biography that you said about 4, maybe?
Yes, somewhere around that age. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of went on from there. I also grew interested in flying. Zoomed for it many years later while undergraduate study. My first go-round of undergraduate study started at Mercer University and ended at Thomas Edison State College, where I started out as a meteorology major, but then ended up finishing up in natural science, which is kind of a broad discipline with concentrations in math, earth science, and physics. Okay. And now I'm finishing up on a second bachelor's at American Military University in Space Studies. As you had mentioned earlier, I founded the African Space Science and Policy Institute a little over a year ago, mm-hmm. About a year and a half. And it's a very interesting time because I'm starting to hand over the helm, if you would, to other members in the group and allow them to take leadership positions so I can kind of step back and engage in more volunteer projects related to the group. And I kind of combine all of my loves, Over time, I developed quite an interest in Africa and the African continent, and that within itself was a long story. And also, of course, my love for space. And I've also been involved in various different causes for human rights. And what the African Space Science and Policy Institute does is combine space travel and the technologies that come out of space travel into a set of strategies that are designed to bring the African continent and the diaspora out of poverty and towards a path of economic growth, food security, and environmental security.
And innovation.
Oh, absolutely, and definitely innovation. And I'm also an instructor. I've been a teacher for a good 8 years, and this year I'm at Quilombo Academic and Cultural Institute, which is out in Lithonia, Georgia. It's my first year there, and it's been a very wonderful experience. Some really bright children there, and they're a wonderful bunch, and they're kind of all like my niece and nephew and football.
I don't know where you are, Gary, but if you're moving around, you're going to want to stay put because you kind of broke up a little there a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Well, I was just basically bragging on my kitties. So,
yeah, you were.
Right.
But, I'm sure they brag on you, too. But what I was going to say, you also, just for the sort of more background on you, you're also a non-believer.
Absolutely.
And you actually started one of the or had one of the very first sort of minority conferences for non-believers.
Oh, absolutely. This was back in 2009. It was myself, and it was attended by quite a few folks. Norm Mellon attended. He's, for those of you that aren't familiar with Norm Mellon and the work that he's done over the years, he's the former director of African Americans for Humanism with the Center for Inquiry, and he's still quite active. And there are quite a few folks that I was able to connect with. Kwajo Obeng, who some of you might know as the man who wrote "You're All Africans." And that's a book that analyzes the effects of the major world religions on creating strife on the African continent, and examine that from history. But a lot of very interesting, very good people came to the conference, and I mean it wasn't a huge crowd, but it was a nice group, and I got a chance to meet a lot of the people that I'm still in contact with today, and they've gone on to organize events. A lot of people were looking for me to do a follow-up, but life kind of happened, and I never got a chance to do a follow-up, and perhaps I'll get into that later. But yes, that conference grew out of the fact that we're in a time where a lot of black non-believers are starting to become more vocal. And starting to become more visible, and this kind of gave us a time to come together and talk about some things, not just about being non-believers, but just putting ourselves in historical cultural context.
Right.
And I mean, because we've always been here. That's one
exactly.
thing that has to be established. Black non-believers are nothing new by any stretch of the imagination. And also just putting things into context about how religiosity affects our community and what we are to do about it in the context of current present-day black America and current present-day black non-believers.
Right. And since we're already on the topic, What, in your opinion, are some of the ways that religiosity hurts the Black community? Does it reduce our skepticism? Does it harm us? And in what ways do you think?
You know, that question doesn't have a simple answer. Because, you know, I think one of the things.
And
that,
is it hyper religiosity, or is it sort of?
Well, yeah, definitely. There is definitely a circle of hyper religiosity within our community that inhibits just about everything. And there's so many different ways we can approach that. We can talk about how it's interfering with our ability to tackle the issue of teen pregnancy from a pragmatic standpoint, because a lot of people with huge levels of religiosity can't approach the topic of sex education from multiple angles that is required. And we can talk about it from the standpoint of having our children be adequately educated in science so that they may go on to do things in medicine and in biological research. We can talk about the inability of our people to deal with HIV and AIDS. Now, mind you, I want to be specific about hyper-religiosity because there are some progressive churches out there and some progressive mosques within the Black community that have been very open-minded towards all the aforementioned issues. And I think they deserve credit for that. What I like to explain to people is that I'm not one to demand that the entire community become non-believers, be they agnostics, atheists, or agnostics or whatever. But what we definitely have to draw the line. We have to draw the line when it comes to fundamentalism and hyper religiosity, and it's like we have to get to the point where if you want to believe that Jesus Christ is your personal Lord and Savior, that's fine. Do you? But keep it out of my science classroom.
Exactly.
Right.
It's about critical thinking.
Exactly.
It's about, you know, if that's what helps you, you know, in your daily life to be a better person, you know, that's fine. But that has nothing to do with, you know, how we evolve to be human beings. It has nothing to do with you know, physics or anything else.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? That is evidence-based or, you know, happens in the physical world.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. So, and you know, and I think, and that's how it should be. And if people want religious answers, I mean, this is why we have Sunday school. This is why we have religious institutions. And I, like, over the years, when the topic comes up in my science classroom, and it has. It comes up. My answer has always been, if you want consultation on your spiritual matters, mm-hmm. consult your pastor. Or so forth and so on. I mean, because it's always not been within my scope. And what we have to get to as a community is a place where we can appreciate that. I don't go inside of Sunday schools and demand that people teach that King Solomon's measurement of the radius to the diameter be 3.14 and not 3, as it is stated in the book of I'm not sure if it was First Kings or I forget exactly what book in the Bible which that verse is contained. Where Solomon takes that measurement, but I don't. You and that would be out of place for me, and likewise.
Just don't come out of that Sunday school class and try to build a building or anything else based on that incorrect information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so and when it comes to that, these are just small examples. You know, like I said, it's so many different angles you can approach this from. For one, it's just we would do ourselves a big favor in understanding our very vast and diverse cultural history in the world, here in the United States, here in through the transatlantic slave trade, and from and also from the perspective of studying our African ancestors, not our American ancestors, and so forth and so on. If we didn't look at things from a lens that is limited to whatever denomination that we came from,
right.
Because we have always been a religiously diverse people.
Right. And speaking of being religiously diverse, you've studied quite a number of religions in your sort of your trek.
Absolutely. This is the area of my life. You know, I begun this conversation by saying I wear a lot of hats. I like to explain to people this is the area of my life where I'm comfortable with no hat. So I was raised in the Presbyterian Church. When I was 18, from the time I was 18 up to the time I was sometime within in my early 20s, I was into Islam, and then I went from Islam to the traditional Yoruba system of spirituality, and I did that for many years. And
would you share with us the name that you acquired?
It's interesting because when I was into the Yoruba tradition, somebody I was studying under had given me the name Balogun, which has become my educational pseudonym, if you would, my educational pinpoint, amongst a lot of the schools that I taught at, and the schools and name stuck, even though I'm no longer into that tradition, and it's not something I have to, you know. Everybody that knows me well knows that I'm a non-believer, it's that organized conference is really a secret. That was one name that I'd taken on over the years.
What does it mean again?
It means warlord.
Oh, if you don't know, warlord.
It's interesting because the name actually. When I look it's improperly named, you would in this.
I'm sorry, Gary. I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're breaking up a little bit. So.
Oh man, it's my provider. My phone gets kind of jacked up at night at sometimes. But I was saying I was actually improperly named because while I was in the tradition. I went through a divination process, and it was determined through that process that I was a child of Shango. And you know, like I said, that time period was that time period,
but you learned a lot, though.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting because a lot of Black Americans that get into the Orisha tradition get into it because they want to. They're on the path to seeking the religious views of their ancestors, and that definitely was my story. But the thing that got me from there to where I am now was a myriad of questions. And one in particular is, like, who says that we have to be religious at all? And if any spiritual system worked for us, rather than solving our problems here on earth as they come, then why did we end up in this situation in the first place?
Exactly. Now, and I think it's that sort of misguided sort of wanting to reconnect with our ancestry that has led to sort of the development of a lot of the sort of spin-offs of of certain religious traditions in our community, like the Hebrew Israelites, Nation of Islam, the Nuwapians, who I'm sure you're familiar with living in Atlanta. Very interesting stuff. But I want to get back to the critical thinking part, because you are an educator and you educate children, and I know you're big on critical thinking and teaching that to your students as a part of science curriculum.
Absolutely.
Because I think you and I both agree that, you know, teaching science isn't just about teaching a whole bunch of facts. It's teaching a method of thinking, or a method of getting to an answer that's more reliable than a lot of other methods you can make.
Well, science is a process, and that is the most important thing that you walk away with from any science class. I mean, if I teach a science class and a child doesn't remember anything I taught in that class but remembers the scientific method forwards and backwards because of all of the times we went through procedure in the various labs and all the projects that we've done, then I'm happy, because what people fail to understand, and this is why so many people are duped by pseudoscience, is that science is a process that has a start and a finish, and the finish leads to a new start. And I think it is very important, and this is not done enough in classrooms.
Tim, are you? I think you unmuted.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm hearing all the stuff in the background. I'm like, you know, we have a ghost on the phone. Or
my apology. It still says mute on my end. Let me try it again.
No problem.
But no, continue. I apologize.
No problem. I was basically saying that it's important to really take spend a lot of time on taking students in a science class through the scientific method, and getting them, teaching them how to study a hypothesis, teach them that the experiment should be directly related to a hypothesis. And to teach them what a control is, what a variable is, what a nuisance variable is, and so forth and so on. How to draw a conclusion based only upon what the experiments produced. And
the parameters, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And to recognize pseudoscience, which is something that seems like science but hasn't gone through the scientific method, and also to recognize bad science, which is something that might have gone through the scientific method, but it just wasn't done good.
Yeah. Just like that, the guy who wrote that article for, I believe it was Psychology Today. What's his name? It escapes me at the moment. But he basically had that study that said that black women Kanagawa, I think that's how you pronounce it. First off, he's not even a scientist, as I understand it. He's an economist, from what I understand.
Exactly. I mean, that was just pure nonsense. It was a poorly done study from start to finish. It had no place being published in a respectable periodical.
Luckily for us, Psychology Today is not a scientific journal, but you're right. It has the appearance of
absolutely.
Of reliability, of being a reputable source of information. But it's really a pop culture sort of,
very
mag.
Much so. It's yeah. very much so a pop psychology type of publication and is not something that someone should go to as a reference for what's going on in the newest psychological research. In fact, honestly, that magazine has been quite prone to perpetrators over the years.
Oh, it definitely has.
And there's that in when you look at educational policy, and you think about how a lot of people in this country that have power in planning educational policy and planning budgets and school systems are firm believers in the bell curve, which is another piece of garbage that is based completely upon pseudoscience that has been disproven multiple times over the years.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why it's so hard to erase the inequities that face our children and that face black children as well as face girls and face any disenfranchised group, because there's a lot of pseudoscience that exists that has drawn bad conclusions a lot of times intentionally. We have to be clear that a lot of bad science is bad science because it was done by people with agendas that wanted to have some type of evidence to further their agendas. And what we have is several examples, being the Psychology Today article, which puts out if you think about the motive behind why these things would do this, then you have to think why would economists be so interested in writing an article like this?
He's written several racist articles. Apparently. And what's so upsetting about that particular article is because the people who originally did the study, they had not intended anything like what he wrote about
right.
it. Because he was basically trying to reinterpret the data. But that,
right.
I mean, it had nothing to do with the design of their study.
Absolutely. And so you have, these are just two examples of why pseudoscience is dangerous, and it just absolutely shouldn't be tolerated or entertained.
I think the other thing is we also have to talk about pseudoscience on the other side, because a lot of people are distrustful of science. They think of it as an establishment, which is, which has a very small grain of truth to it.
But it is not
big science. There's no hive mind in science. There's scientists all over the world doing science all the time, checking each other, disagreeing with each other, arguing with each other. But what comes out of that eventually, and for the most part, is truth.
Disagreeing with each other to the point where they almost get into fights at conferences, into fist fights.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. There's definitely no hive mind in the scientific community whatsoever.
Right.
It the process of reaching a scientific consensus is quite an arduous process. You
it
definitely
is.
Have to roll up your sleeves and you present. If you do a study and present a conclusion, some folks are going to try you. You know,
right?
It's like
and no one conclusion is ever held up as absolute truth. It's
right.
It's a process. If you hold up a theory and you say that this is the best theory, that theory is supported by quite a lot of evidence.
Absolutely,
so.
Absolutely. And so, and that's
and that's the goal of science, which most people don't understand. It's the theory.
Well, absolutely, and you know, it's funny you mention that because another thing that is very hard that is very important to point out, because a lot of books are still. Inaccurately, a lot of K through 12 books are still inaccurately stating that things are proven in science are called laws, and
right.
This is not true.
Right. That's for a reason. It supports the nonsense of trying to get intelligent design and other pseudoscience into the classroom.
Absolutely. So, and so it's really important to point out that an untested claim is a hypothesis. A hypothesis comes before an experiment. Theories come after experiments.
Right.
And the reason why we use theory and not law is because not because theory is not valid, but
right.
because it is an explanation that is subject to expansion as better knowledge becomes available.
Right, whereas laws are generally are just general tendencies. It's like, you know, we call room temperature 72 degrees. You
right,
know what I
right.
mean? That's not
right.
interesting. There's nothing
right.
interesting about that. You know,
exactly.
when you drop a pencil, it falls to the ground. There's nothing particularly interesting about that. But it's,
right,
a,
right.
but it's a law that that's going to happen.
Absolutely. So, you know, these are things that are important to point out, and that
right.
that are really crucial to developing scientifically literate children, and to the point where it's not enough to teach children that there is gravity and that planets orbit around the sun, and things of the sort. But they have to understand the scientific method as a process and why we were able to discover these things, what experiments occurred, and going let's just take the Big Bang Theory, for example. To understand the historic experiments that occurred, like the cosmic radiation background, that explains that the global temperature of the universe and how it's decreasing over time, how the universe is expanding, and how these various different forms of evidence came together. From many, many years of experiments,
right,
and how previous notions of the universe of being constant have been disproven,
mm-hmm.
and so also via experimentation, and so the idea is experimentation gets evidence
right.
Produces supports theories. And so,
right.
What inevitably the scientific method is, I like the way Neil deGrasse Tyson explained it once, is a process where that allows us to learn without deluding ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Where we all try to the best we can minimize our biases. And allow the evidence to be the final say-so.
Right, absolutely. And that's why, and just like we were bringing up, you know, I guess those who are viewed as being a part of the scientific establishment, practicing pseudoscience, that's why it's so important to teach critical thinking, because there's a lot of people who represent themselves as being anti-establishment that some people automatically, become
attracted to. Well, automatically cling to them. Absolutely, right.
Right. So, just because they don't represent, you know, this thing, this body that they think exists in science, where we have a hive of mind, and they get attracted to the Layla Africa's and Dr. Shady's of the world.
Well, it's the appeal to spite fallacy, and so definitely it's important to put everything in the context. I mean, we can understand when you understand the history of our community and things that we've gone through. We have historically been disenfranchised by hospitals, by HMOs, by insurance companies. So you can understand why there is a bit of collective recalcitrance on the behalf of people in our community. But then there's also an old saying, an old colloquialism that we have here in the South that's very popular among Black Americans, and that is, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right. And just because something is justified, an idea or a belief is justified in the sense that, you know, one could have some resentment or some ill feeling towards, you know, a particular group because of something that happened to you, doesn't mean that what you believe about them, that anything that you think about them is true.
Right.
So your mistrust may be justified, but your idea that everything that comes from them is false or is designed to hurt you is not necessarily the case.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The appeal, again, the appeal to spite fallacy,
mm-hmm.
and so it's important that I'm a little past calling out particular quacks that target our community by name. I've done enough of that already.
You have.
So I tend not to want to rag on people for too long. Because that just backfires and gives them more attention than they deserve. But one of the unifying factors is, I think
sometimes you have to call them out because I think some people, I think you do have to call them out occasionally because of misinformation and the lack of, the brokenness in our education system and sort of the lack of critical thinking that gets promoted in our community allows a lot of this misinformation that they sell, you know, to be propagated.
Absolutely.
And it's hard, to sit there and tackle everything that comes
right,
up.
Right, right.
So it's
right.
useful occasionally to use one or two of them as an example.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But of course, you're right in a sense that because of the cult of personality, sometimes for dealing with some people, it's counterproductive.
Right.
Because they've bought the person because the person is the product.
Absolutely, and these people have the following that they have because they're strong in the science. I mean, obviously, their science is crap. They've along with just like anybody else that's accumulated a cult of personality, they've mastered the art of using charisma and flattery to gain people's trust.
Right.
So,
But getting back to your classroom, what are some of the examples that you use in your classroom or things that you could even do at home as a parent to kind of, you know, teach your children some basic critical thinking skills?
Oh, well, I like to start with things that they talk about. on a regular basis, things that float around. Urban legends are really good. One in particular that I do just about every year is the whole Coke, Pork, and Worms thing.
Now explain
amazing.
That one from the beginning.
Well, it's amazing how that never goes away. That you know, there's still people out there that think that if you take a can of pork and you pour it on some pour it on some pork, and all of a sudden these worms would just come out. But of course, whenever we do the experiment, you know, it's a lot of people, they come and say, oh, yeah, we're going to create some worms. We're going to create some worms. And then we pour the cocoa on and nothing happens. So
right.
it is, and you know, and then there are other things that you can do. Like, if you know, Coke is the target of a lot of urban legends. There's the whole thing that Coke can eat a nail. That's actually one of the very easy one to deal with.
Only if the nail is not made of tooth enamel and you leave it in there for a year.
Right, exactly. So you tell them, okay, well, let's try it. You drop the nail in the Coke, and of course nothing happens.
Right.
So, you know, just things like, I love dealing with urban legends. Because they deal with things that the children have heard of, and they deal with things that can be tested. And of course, a lot of them, well, not, I wouldn't say a lot of them, but many of them have seen shows like Mythbusters. You know, I really wish PBS would pick up that show or something like that, because, I mean, There's still a lot of people out there that don't have access to cable television.
That is true.
Right, and can't see Mythbusters. But that is a good, I mean, some of the shows they have kind of say, okay, Adam and Jamie, you guys are kind of going a little too far with that. It's like,
well,
but,
you know, I mean, one of the main criticisms that a lot of people have of the Mythbusters is that they're not actually doing always the most scientific experiment, but
right.
I think it's useful, you know, from the perspective that, you know, it's a demonstration, even if they're
absolutely
not doing it 100% in the most scientific way. At least
absolutely
it's a demonstration of what's possible or what
absolutely,
you know, or what's impossible. You know
absolutely,
what I mean?
And it reiterates
it's
picking
dirty
the point.
Yeah,
right. It reiterates the point that. Some of the things you hear are testable. So before you believe them, check them out.
Right.
And
probably,
you know,
stay away from the explosives. Let Jamie and
right,
let
right
Jamie and them handle that.
Exactly. But you know, the whole rice thing where you talk to rice and it doesn't, if you talk nice to rice and it doesn't rot, and you insult the rice and
you,
it rots.
Or you like, you know, you send good vibes to your water and then try to freeze it.
Right, right.
You know, and see what kind of crystals you get and see how beautiful they are.
Exactly.
Yeah,
those types of things are testable. And before you start using them in your conversations, how about test them and see if they're correct? I mean, it's like, and some of the things that and I mean, having kids do those types of experiments, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun because they hear these things, and then, of course, when at the end of it, most of the time they have an aha moment. Now, on occasion, interestingly enough, on occasion, you'll have a child that will go through the experiment completely, and then after having seen the result, they'll still want to hang on to that old idea.
Right.
And you know, children deal with selective acceptance just like adults do.
Right.
It's very interesting to compare the selective acceptance of children with the selective acceptance of adults. A lot of times with children, they just need time to think about it and grow up. But with adults,
I think you and I are both living examples of this.
I hope so.
I hope so as well. I think we should probably get into some of your other ventures, because I really want everyone to kind of, I want to highlight those, because I think that you've done a lot of good work.
Thank you.
I know you've written a book.
And
could you tell everyone the name of your book?
I've written a couple, actually.
You have written a couple. You know what? I'm thinking about the one about working with youth.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll talk about that one. The 7 Laws of Successful Youth Work. That, you know, I wrote that one back in 2005. That was actually my first book. I basically just wanted to, you know, it's working with young people is something that you have to continue to study it, and you can never learn too much about it. And you know, I by no means want to project myself as just some type of Jedi master with all the answers on how to reach the youth.
You've done a lot of work with youth in your career, though. So.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, surely you have some wisdom.
But what I did was I just wanted to kind of put together 7 points that illustrate some of the things that I've done that have been successful through my career as a teacher, through my career as in youth development and other capacities. And put it out there so that anybody that wants to get involved with young people can have a starting point and pick up some things and take some things into account. But I will share a couple of the points. One, which is the very first point in the book, is teaching is loving. In order to be successful in any type of capacity of working with young people, you have to have a compassionate heart, because children are not going to always be perfect little smiley, bubbly people that just have that do everything right. Sometimes they're going to defy you. Sometimes they're going to mouth off and talk back. And all kinds of things, but you have to understand that these are human beings, and human beings have a story, and also it's just, you know, part of your part of the joy of the human experience is loving other human beings, and teaching. In a lot of ways, you're not just presenting information. You're helping this person grow intellectually. That is the first and foremost thing. And of course, there are other rules that I put out in the book. And so it's a short read. It's less than 100 pages. So if somebody wanted to get involved with young people as a volunteer or anything, hopefully it would be a nice starting point for them.
Well, we'll have to post some of the some links to your other works, and certainly your articles, because you've written a number of really good articles as well on the RSS feed wall, so people can
see
those out there. And two weeks ago, I posted a bunch of your videos from YouTube. A lot of them. One where you had a discussion with a black gynecologist, where you were talking about racism in Darwin. There's really one I like where you were talking about pseudoscience.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there was one. And there's another one that I like that you did talking about Because there's this idea in some circles that we're not supposed to be meat eaters, or you know, we're not omnivorous by nature or something.
Oh yes,
and so
right.
You thoroughly debunked that, and I liked how thorough you were there. And there's a lot of other skepticism versus closed-mindedness. That was a good one. Really good stuff. I remember also didn't you recently have a fundraising effort for African Space Science Policy Institute?
I did. The way I like to fundraise is I like to make my fundraisers project specific. So recently I engaged in the African Rocketry Project. I didn't quite raise as much money as I wanted. In fact, you know, by this thing being so new, a lot of it I've just been pumping my own funds into. And so I actually do want to get to the point where there is more, there's more of a concerted effort to fundraise. But getting back to the African Rocketry Project, myself, a few of my teacher friends in Namibia, and a good friend at VR Junior Academy that I met while I visited Kenya in January, and a friend of mine in Uganda that's also a teacher, decided to begin a rocketry project to introduce children to model rockets. We decided to stick with water rockets because fire rockets, of course, have a whole another liability issue. And also, in Kenya, they're banned right now because of the issue with Al-Shabaab.
Right.
So that project is actually still very much in its preliminary stages. I'm still acquiring all the materials, and I've yet to send out any shipments. So it's still very much in the beginning stage where I'm acquiring the materials. I mean, we have the contacts. The curriculum is being put together, and hopefully we'll.
And that's
what
I wanted to ask you to explain to everyone, because I don't know that when you know, because I know that I've tried to promote you quite a lot, and I don't think that people necessarily grasp the significance of teaching children how to, particularly with the water situation. I mean, anyone can, you know, put something, well, not anyone, but, you know, it takes some ingenuity, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
In a different sort of way to make a water rocket versus a fire rocket.
Oh, absolutely.
But you, maybe you could explain what all would go into teaching children how to put these in the air.
Well, there's so many different lessons that can be learned from that. Number one, the mathematical skills that we learn about volume, and then it goes into physics where you learn about pressure, and how converting pressure and volume into energy inside of the rocket, and how the energy can be used to get the rocket into the air, how the various different aerodynamic factors affect the rocket, how you design it, making sure that the rocket isn't too heavy. There's a lot of skills, a lot of work that goes into it. I mean, there's not.
And then you have to write the report.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Who cares if there aren't any results to report, right? And then there's also meteorology, because you have to think about where the rocket's going to land, and you know,
absolutely,
and all that
absolutely
kind of stuff. So there's a lot of things that can be learned.
Absolutely, there's a lot of lessons that can go into it, and you know, it's and number one, that so there's the basic STEM skill sets that they can learn from it, and two, it's a matter of getting youth on the African continent to start dreaming.
Right.
because a lot of the issues on the African continent and throughout the diaspora, you know, the youth just need to have a chance to dream.
Right.
And we need a generation of dreaming children to grow up and change Africa from inside. And this is what it's going to take to get Africa away from the point where it's constantly dependent upon aid, outside sources of aid from nations that used to colonize it. And I think we have to get the youth there to see themselves as scientists and as activists and as community builders. And to connect that, and you know, when having a project that has them building model rockets and dreaming of a space program being in their country one day.
And there's only two countries on the continent right now that have these programs, correct?
That's correct. As far as I know, actually, there's quite a few actually. South Africa has a government organized space program. The Nigerians have a government organized space program. The Algerians have a government organized space program, and if I'm not mistaken, I might be mistaken. Egypt at one time did. I'm sure the ousting of Mubarak might have slowed that down quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that would have kiboshed on that.
Right, in the events of Arab Spring. That Nigeria actually has a satellite in orbit, and actually Nigeria's satellite was one of the first satellites to photograph the damage of Hurricane Katrina.
I hadn't realized that.
And so that, yeah, it's called Nigeria Sat 1, and so you know it's so amazing because if Nigeria could just get past its internal strife issues, the country has so much potential.
I think the other thing to note too is that while obviously a lot of progress can be achieved through the sort of nationally funded, you know, government run space programs, I think there's a lot of promise in for profit space travel and exploration, and I think we talked about this before.
Oh, absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me tell you, the African continent also has that. You know, there, my good friend Chris Nasamba in Uganda, who I am co-writing a book with, and that will be published before the end of this year, has started a space program from scratch, from donations and so forth and so on, and you can actually find a few articles on the internet where he has been building a space shuttle from plans that he put together from scratch in his mother's backyard. And he calls it the African Skyhawk. I'm doing the best I can to support Chris and some of the things that he's been doing. He's a really good guy, very ambitious guy. He's convinced that there's UFOs out there, and of course quite a bit skeptical of that. That aside, I hugely appreciate the work ethic that he has towards getting into space, and he's not. Don't get me wrong. The Ugandan government knows what he's doing, and they've expressed their willingness to commit to supporting him, and I like that. But he didn't wait on them. He started the program on his own.
Right.
And some fellows in the Congo are doing it and have a very similar story. You know, they didn't wait on the Congolese government. They couldn't because the Congo has been in the midst of civil war for
quite a
bit of time. And it's only recently calmed down a little bit. But those they was like, whatever, civil war or not, if we want to go to space. They started building high powered rockets and sending them up. And actually there's a couple of news reports of those on YouTube, where they built the Troposphere family of rockets and they've launched several of them. And so they're private ventures on the African continent that citizens are engaging in. They are not waiting. They are doing what they can to perform their role in making this happen. And those guys really could use our support. And of course, that's one of the motivating factors behind the African Space Policy Institute existing. Now, as far as commercial efforts go elsewhere.
What do you think of the most promising ones?
I really like what Richard Branson is doing. I think he has, you know, I've always appreciated Richard Branson as an entrepreneur. He's developed a knack for taking odd, unusual ideas and making them very successful. And so I do appreciate that. I like the fact that he
has vision.
Absolutely. And he went full speed ahead with creating America's first spaceport. So he's going full speed ahead with Spaceship Two. And I've flown on this airline before, Virgin Atlantic, and it's a nice airline. So the way he runs his space travel operation the way he runs his airline, then he'll be in good shape.
Do you think? I've been reading on this. What do you think about the idea of a space elevator?
I'm not throwing my chips in with that.
You're not so much in. I wasn't so much either. I think the idea is really interesting, but I think it poses a lot of problems.
Oh, of course.
It poses more problems than it solves issues. Like,
I mean, it's,
you know,
it's awesome on paper.
We've talked about this before. Because of, you know, the payload that one has to take into space, you know, to... You know, the astronauts, water, food, everything else. You know, just getting a rocket off the ground consumes a lot of fuel.
Oh, absolutely.
One understands why the idea of a space elevator, you know, would be attractive.
Absolutely.
But it poses, I think, a lot more problems than it would solve.
Absolutely, and it's one of those things. I mean, on paper, any idea is a good idea. But you know, it's you know, there's been a lot of things. One of my personal strategies, I actually am a huge proponent of using high altitude airships, and I'm not the only person that does. There's a guy by the name of Jonathan Powell out in California who heads up JP Aerospace, and he's been doing experiments for many years, including one where he built one of his airships that reached very, very high altitude. There's also the Red Bull Stratus project that has a guy that's a world-renowned skydiver that is trying to break Colonel Joseph Kittinger's record. To tell your audience a little bit about Colonel Joseph Kittinger, Colonel Kittinger, who at the time was Captain Kittinger, did a jump from the Excelsior 2 balloon during the year 1960, before the Mercury astronaut program, before Yuri Gagarin went up. He didn't quite make it to the FAI defined boundary of space, which is 100 kilometers. But he actually made it quite far up to that point. And, like maybe midways in between the point, and then he jumped out of the balloon and fell so fast because of the altitude that he nearly broke the sound barrier. And,
yeah.
Of course, when he reentered the atmosphere, he kind of used regular skydiving tactics. But the Red Bull Stratus project is actually trying to take a balloon up to the edge of space and have a skydiver jump out and come back down and break Colonel Kettinger's record. And actually, Colonel Kettinger is an advisor to the project, so it's looking very promising. And,
nice.
So I actually have quite a few ideas for using airships as alternatives to using rockets, and I like this idea simply because rockets. I mean, it's amazing watching a rocket. Obviously, I love rockets because I'm doing programs on the African continent that teach rocketry.
Right.
But as much as I love rockets, I actually want to obviate them. Because they come, as amazing of machines as they come with so many liabilities. Number one, if an emergency goes wrong, you have split seconds to react. Whereas if something goes wrong in an airship, you have, depending on the problem, you can have hours to react. If it's a small problem, you can just basically wait for the airship to coast back to the surface.
When you say airships, like what sort of gas are they talking about using in airships? Are they actual like hot air, or I just want people to be clear.
There are different types of airships. There's thermal airships that are basically just airships that use the same propulsion technology as hot air balloons.
Okay.
And there's gas balloons that use helium. Now, the thing about
helium is precious, though.
That's what I was thinking. Helium is starting to become a precious resource that is becoming very hard to find, which is why, and we can't go back to using hydrogen, obviously, because of the Hindenburg accident and other accidents that occurred like it. There are other alternatives. One, the thermal airship. If we can get to the point where we can start making high altitude airships that also carry a supply of oxygen, so that that they could continue to burn hot air as it reaches really high altitudes where the atmosphere is very thin, and there's just not enough oxygen for your typical combustion to occur, then this could be a possible modality of replacing gas helium balloons, which is eventually going to have to be done. I mean, helium is just so precious that something has to give. We can't keep sending gas balloons up. We're going to find alternatives. Believe it or not, nitrogen can be used as a lighter than air gas with some buoyancy. It's not very good, but it's not really efficient. Right,
yeah.
I should say. But it is possible, and it has been done before.
Okay.
And there are a variety of alternatives out there that are on the table.
Excellent. I was going to say, last week, or not last week, 2 weeks ago when we were supposed to have this conversation before, we covered a lot of sort of the contributions of NASA to our daily lives and, you know, to medicine and to other various fields. And without getting, you know, completely into that conversation, I just wanted to know, because I know that one of your things is taking sort of space technologies, sustainability technologies, and sort of using that to improve the lives of these children on the continent. So I just wanted to ask, you know, what your projects were related to that effort.
Well, you see, there's, well first, to get into some of those, I mean, there are really too many contributions that space technology has made to name. I will just say shortly that if it were not for the space race, and if it were not for the for the technologies that came out of the space race, those of us that live in first world countries, our lifestyle as we know it would not be possible. This radio
Absolutely.
Show would not be possible. Me
Absolutely.
Calling you and from this cell phone and talking to you, as none of this would be possible. So our lives as we know it would absolutely not exist.
So
with that being said, there's no way we can take space out of the equation when we start talking about developing third world countries, because the advantages that we have within our lifestyle are the result of that. So when we talk about economic development, you're talking about building telecoms in this country and in these countries. How are you going to do this without satellites? How are you going to monitor environmental issues without geostationary satellites to watch these? I mean, these are things. The reason why we have early warning technology is because of these things. The reason why we are able to identify hurricanes in the Atlantic days before they hit landfall is because of these space technologies. Before these space technologies existed, people were dying by the droves whenever a hurricane hit landfall, and a lot of the problems that we have in third world countries that are environmental, where people die in large amounts, is because they don't have access to the technologies that we have access to. So when people say, why are we sending people up in space, why are we sending things up in space, the answer to that is to maintain your standard of living.
To improve it in some instances.
Right, exactly. So, I think people grossly underrate the importance of space technology in our lives, and as a result, they underrate the role that space technology absolutely must play in the development of African nations. Now, to get back to your question, some of the projects that I want to get involved in, right now, all of our basic projects have been those of generating interest in improving and integrating the idea of getting space, using space as a tool of development into the young population of African students, but eventually want to move on to doing other things. I had a conversation with Peter Ngoya, who is the health minister in Kenya, some months back, about e-health. This is one application that I would like to get into very soon, developing a website that has resources where Kenyans that have access to the internet can tap into. But not only that, but it provides information using GIS. For those of you that don't know, GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. And it relates to technologies that we use in Google Earth which, again, wouldn't be possible without space technologies that we have, that will allow for things that are environmental health related, that are very important to Kenyans, like wildfires and things of that sort, that will have this information available so that anybody who needed it could access it. Right now, nothing of this sort exists in Kenya. Moving up to things such as this, and maybe even later down the line, this is not on the table now because obviously these are bigger projects, but supporting initiatives to get things up in the air, such as maybe modifying high altitude weather balloons so that they could be used for telecommunications applications. These are certain ideas that are on the table at the moment.
And so
definitely what must happen from now, the plan for African Space Science and Policy Institute right now is to improve educational opportunities and to do things that are involved in food security. Another thing I forgot to mention is the issue of food security, using technologies for food preservation and growing. One in particular is hydroponics. Hydroponics I won't say that it is the result of space technology, but actually the space science community has put a lot of work into developing hydroponics for space station applications and so forth and so on. But this could be, this is definitely something that could and should be dealt with on the African continent in terms of helping out with food security and basically growing food in the midst of droughts using greenhouses and hydroponics and rainwater collection systems. And also coming up with food preservation systems so that these things could come so that we could get food as well as keep food and having good food banks. So those are some of the biggest issues that are on the table for development within the next 5 years of the organization.
Excellent. That sounds great. And obviously technologies that'll be important to any future plans, you know, that we may have, I say we, and I mean humanity may have, to having long-term, colonies or bases, you know, outside of, you know, the International Space Station. And possibly in our future, which I know some of the things I've read up on are asteroid mining.
Absolutely.
And other things. So it'll be really interesting. Well, we don't have very much time left, but I definitely want to have you back on the show because I think I'd like to talk about some issues that need to be debunked amongst some people in our community regarding particularly things like the moon landing hoax.
And some of these
perennial alignment stories that you come across occasionally.
Oh, yes, of course. You mean you're not going to sell all your stuff in December?
No. I think I saw one more recently where someone was suggesting that the pyramids of Giza, they had some sort of alignment with a formation of stars. Which is completely untrue. You have to alter the picture, and you have to not only alter the picture, but alter your view and everything in order to see it this way. it's just not true. And there's a whole lot of other things, especially like astrology, I find. There's a lot of people who believe in astrology in our community. So
well,
I think we may have to have you back to talk about that. And, of course, you know, a lot of other issues because, you know, obviously you're not just in the space science. You've studied all of the natural sciences, and, you know, you're also interested in issues of climate change.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of issues pertaining to climate change that affect third world countries that third world countries aren't necessarily part of the conversation always.
Right.
So, and some of those issues just affect those countries disproportionately. So, so that's something we'd have to talk about. And I thank you so much for being on my show. And
wow, thank you so much for having me. It was.
And they can find you on Twitter, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Just hit me up, Gary Booker. That's my Twitter name.
Gary Booker on Twitter and Gary Booker on YouTube and
yes.
African Space Policy, Space Science and Policy Institute on
yes.
Facebook.
Yes,
and what else? Where else are you?
Well, you can go to my website at GaryBooker.net. Pardon the electronic dust. It's still under construction, certain parts of it. To get into
some
of the things.
He has the most adorable pictures of him as a child in, like, in like jumpsuits and, like, little beanie hats. And he has pictures. And he has some pictures of him engaged in one of his favorite hobbies, which is hang gliding, which we didn't get to talk about, which I think is really interesting because you're probably the only person I know that hang glides. So, but, you know, that's like being, that's, I mean, that's like way beyond being black and swimming. Like, I'm just joking. You know, that's like a major, you know, like a major stereotype in our community, but it's not something that you often come across in anyone. But I think that's pretty interesting. So you can check that out. Hopefully there'll be some inspiration for you to try your, you know, a new hobby, possibly
no
hang gliding. I thank you so much. I really do appreciate it, and we'll have to have you back on. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. And with that, I think we're out.
All right, folks. Thanks for having me once again, and it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care.
Okay. Can they hear me, Kim? No?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I didn't know. Okay. Hey, guys. Thanks so much for listening to this interview. Unfortunately, we couldn't make it a live show only because of Gary has other appointments and he's a very busy man, so. I'm glad that we got to do the show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. If you have any questions for Gary or questions about anything that you heard on the show, anything you want more information on, be sure to hit me up on the RSS feed wall or to contact Gary directly via his Twitter. And I believe his other contact information is available through the African Space Science Institute and through his Gary Booker website. In any case, I promise I will get better about announcing these shows. It's sort of somewhat difficult to get things together right now because of personal issues that have been going on in my life, but I promise with a capital P that we will be getting this together. And so within the next week, you'll have you'll have a plan for the next, for all of the shows from now until the end of the year. So, I do thank you for listening. I appreciate all the love and support that I've gotten from some of you. And I hope that you tell your friends. And, you know, we're just going to keep growing and learning together. So it'll be a lot of fun. Anyway, thanks so much again. Hope to talk to you guys soon. Bye.